The following presentations were from the series of lightning talks at Network Shop 42 in April 2014.
So I would like to call on, next of all, Matthew from Leicester to talk to us all about free radius and DHCP. I understand you don't have slides, so...
No, I wrote it in the bus last night, so...
Brilliant. That is exactly how we intend this to work. So
it's good to see more than two people here.
Here we go then. Your time starts now.
Well, I guess most people using DHCP on their network somewhere, and a lot of people use IFC, which we certainly do. And I guess the question is, why would you look at anything else, especially free radius, because that sounds completely crazy, and it honestly is. But we've had a few problems with IFC recently, and on its own it's fine, but when you start looking at the failover protocols when you're running two servers, you find it will crash and just, the both sides will shut themselves down and you just cry. So I thought there must be something better, and you find out that free radius can do DHCP now. Haven't looked at this in work time, because that would also be crazy, but I've looked at it at home. And so let's have a go. Why can you do DHCP and free radius, and what's the point? You can run two servers, you can run an SQL database behind it, and run your SQL databases in visiting mode. There's a lot of options, which with IFC you're stuck with their text format of leases file, and you're very flexible in what you can do. So it works fairly well, because the DHCP packets are attributes and values in very similar to the way that radius packets are attributes and values. So the incoming packets hit free radius, it decodes the DHCP packet into attributes and values, you can process them in whatever way you want, and then the outgoing packet generator converts them back into DHCP packets and sends them back out again. Fits fairly well. So a quick how-to on the latest version 3.02, or the head tree, it's fairly straightforward. I did a patch a few weeks ago just to make it a bit easier to work, and this is about my experience with it. But you can configure it with SQLite, which obviously for resilience isn't a good thing, but for just playing around and testing with it, works quite well. So you can enable a DHCP virtual server, which if you view free radius at all, it's a symlink, just the site enabled directory. You need to edit that, because by default the config is totally broken on purpose, because if you fire free radius on your network and you don't want it answering your DHCP packets, it's probably not going to help things. So things like the DHCP port will be listening on port 6700 rather than 67, different things like that. So there are comments in the file you have to change to fix it and to tell you what to do. You have to set your network options, such as the gateway, DNS, option things that you have to do in IFC anyway, lease times. And they're done in free radius if you're using unlang, or another method of using free radius can be looking up into a database. So you get the incoming packets, you then set your reply attributes, and they're the ones that are sent out on the wire back to the client. You then, at the moment, have to edit the SQL database creation file to list all of the IP addresses that are going to be available in your call. So you currently can't say from this IP to this IP as you could in IFC, but you have to list them all. And then you just fire it through radius. It will automatically correct the database and start going. Obviously with MySQL or something, or Postgres or something, you'd have to do more work to create the database, but the idea with this is just you can have a play and fire it up and give it a go. So pretty much the code is all there, and the actual C code that you free radius, the decodes the packets, encodes the packets again, and that works. The logic isn't. So at the moment, literally, all you get is a decoded DHCP packet, and you can do something with that, and then you can create your new packet to send it out, and so obviously you have to have two, because there's a discover, and then an offer, and then a request, and an act. So you have to currently handle that. And that's the bit that he's doing. So there's no real sort of logic around it. I think it's got some promise in the future. Is it ready now? No. Don't go and deploy free radius to do your DHCP on the network, because you'll be crying even more than using IFC. But I think in the coming forward, it does sound crazy, but having tried it, it does work. You've got an option of far more options of resilience for your database back end. Think of your request comes in to DHCP, you go off and query your IP address IP server, rather than doing it completely separately. So if you've got IP address management, you could go and query that directly, rather than having to sort things out. So it's an interesting thing to play around with. Have fun if you want to try it.
Just before you sit down, does anyone have one quick question for Matthew?
Well, one quick point, if you're using it with static things, it does work quite nicely. But there's also another virtual server, which is an ARP watcher. So for your networks that it's on, you can actually sniff and check for the rooted address for that network. So when you sniff out, it's just like the old kind of ARP watch, and it can alert you that if something's changed on that network.
If anyone knows Alan de Kock with Free Rage, he's crazy as well, which is why all these protocols make their way into a rating server. But it's interesting.
Okay. Was there another one?
Hi, I'm Matt Bernstein at LSE. It sounds like you could program with Unlang the DHCP element maybe as flexibly as you could the Radius element. So one thing that appeals to me, could you do a lease time dynamically based on how full the scope is? So ISC's got a slightly lesser known coarse-grained option to do that, which is brilliant. But it sounds like if you can program it yourself, you could just have a nice smooth curve.
Yeah, literally, the lease time is one of the options you can set in the reply packet that goes out. So by default, you would just set a default in the virtual server, but you can set it to whatever you want in Unlang, same as the gateway DNS, everything else.
Excellent.
Brilliant. Thank you very much once again. I'd now like to call on David Cheetham from GoTech, who's going to talk to us about IPv6.
Thank you.
Over to you.
I'm David Cheetham. I'm the Interim General Manager of GoTech, which was formerly known as the Camp Man some years ago. I'm a more recent addition because GoTech has been really in a state of dormancy for the last sort of year and a half, because my colleague, John Aldington, who some of you might have met at previous network workshops, was seconded to run the re-procurement for Kent Public Services Network. And John has been gainfully employed, 150% in that procurement, which means that virtually all GoTech activity has stopped. But I'm trying to resurrect activity across the FHE community in Kent. And the first event that I'm put together is about IPv6. And we're hoping to do a kind of briefing workshop for certainly colleagues amongst the Kent colleges and universities. But we also want to extend the invitation to colleagues in London and Sussex and well, anybody who fancies making the trip to Canterbury on the 1st of May. We're going to be holding the conference at Canterbury Christchurch University, which is right in the city centre, a short walk from the train station, 50 minutes on the high-speed one from St Pancras, which is why we think it's kind of accessible for a wider area. And the sort of things we're going to focus on is the first half of the morning is going to be around a sort of management briefing to give people an opportunity to encourage their senior managers to perhaps attend to find out what IPv6 is all about and why we should be concerned about it. We're going to be supported in that kind of strategic session by Guy Sudran from Janet. We're also going to do a technical update provided by Roy Evans from Janet. And the rest of the day is going to be much more case study focused around some examples of colleagues around the country who've actually done IPv6 or are planning IPv6. So the bulk of the day is going to be focused on planning, implementation, and the sort of issues that we should all be thinking about. so, not sure what my timing is, but Oh, yeah. So, as I say, it's May the 1st, 9:30 to 4:30, Canterbury Christchurch University, in the centre of Canterbury. you can find out more about it from the GoTech website, which is GoTech is goetec.ac.uk. We're taking registrations of interest at the moment at the email address that's on the flyer. And we will be setting up an Eventbrite site next week where we can actually take bookings. It's free. There's going to be tea and coffee morning and afternoon and lunch provided. My name's David Cheetham. My email address is david.cheetham@canterbury.ac.uk if you want to find out more about it. And I'm particularly interested to hear from colleagues who I've not uncovered yet who have done some IPv6 work and might be interested in actually taking part, a more active part in the day's activities and sharing a case study approach. Okay?
Absolutely thank brilliant. Thank you to David. I'm guessing for the sort of event style thing is not really a questions topic, but if anybody does have anything to ask him about the event, either email him at the address he's given or catch him in the balance of the conference. So from one David to another, could I call on Dave Eagle from Teesside to come up and join us? Do you have any slides
at all?
In which case, I will press the magic button and restart the timer, and over to you.
You're just going
to
give me 21 seconds there, which would have been impressive. Right, hello, from Teesside University. I want to talk about people. We have information governance is obviously important to us. It's not the technical stuff, but the people side matters as well. We went through, like most institutions, I imagine, we went through a massive push to try and streamline our records management some time ago. Got lots of staff involved, lots of admin staff in particular. Got them to own the problem, got them to redefine all their processes, work out what all their documents were, put sensitivity on them, put criticality on them, then work out how they were going to manage them, where they were going to store them, where they were going to, how they were going to store them, how they're going to dispose of them, who was going to have access, who wasn't going to have access. Went through this whole thing and created a massive data retention set of policies about that, deep in paper. But it was a very, you know, valuable exercise. The problem is we completely ignored what you might call the elephant in the room, which is what people hold in their offices, particularly academic staff. This was totally corporate space data. It was nothing to do with what people have in offices. And we still haven't addressed that issue. And we're now talking about addressing that issue. And that, I mean, really is where the big challenge is. How do you find out what people have? How do you get them to even recognize what they've got? In my office, I can honestly say there's probably stuff which has got personal data on it from students from 20 years ago, and it's still in my office on paper. I've no idea where it is exactly. I've got stuff from external organisations that I've been involved with, including criminal justice organisations, where they're confidentially marked documents. They're probably not confidential anymore because they're, you know, they're so old. But they're all nice and secure, but how do I dispose of them? Do I even need to have them? Well, I can tell you now I don't need to have them. So, you know, we've got some real kind of issues there, some liabilities there, and lots of staff will have stuff like that. So the big question is, how do you address that? How do you manage the non-corporate data? And how do you get people to start recognising what they've got? Now, we've got a few ideas. We've come up with a few ideas of how we might address this. We thought we might do some auditing of some friendly people who didn't mind being audited, and then publicise the results of those audits, of what was found and how we dealt with it and disposed of it. Obviously, we could do some training, but academic staff and training, academic staff and anything, frankly. And I'm speaking as an academic. I should point out, I am a member of the academic staff. I'm not a member of the technical staff or anything, so I know how difficult it is. Why has this become a big focus for me at the moment? Well, I've just become a staff governor, and now I realise I have legal liabilities. So my interest now is to stop that from happening. So other ideas, we thought we might have an amnesty. We thought we might get one of these shredding lorries, confidential shredding lorries, to park on the campus and just say to people, bring out your dead. But basically, we're trying to stop the shitstorm from happening. And I'm really interested if anyone else has got any ideas of how you've achieved it, if you have achieved it. Or are you all sat there thinking we have exactly the same problem? And I suspect a lot of people do have exactly the same problem. We don't know what academics have got. And they probably don't know either. And it's like herding cats anyway. And I think I'm finished early.
Fantastic. So thank you, Dave. I think this... this is a topic which I imagine a few of you might have questions. So if anybody has anything to ask. Okay.
If it's useful historical stuff and we have a purpose for it, then I guess we could keep it. A lot of the stuff I'm thinking about is really, it's dangerous stuff potentially. I mean, we could, for example, if you imagine, we could have exam results, module results, detailed module results, which we don't normally get to keep these days. In the modern world, if we go to an exam board, they take everything off us at the end. In fact, they put it all on a screen now. They don't even give us it on paper. But in the old days, they used to give us all printouts of every student's results, and we used to just take them into our offices, and we've got piles of them stacked in corners. Now, the next Prime Minister's data could be in there. You know, so we have to think very carefully, how do we dispose of that information? Do we even know we've got it? And so I think some of the historical stuff, yeah, might be useful, but the personal stuff, I think, it's unlikely we'll find any justification for keeping it. And there's lots of personal stuff.
Anybody else?
David Wall at Leeds. It's not just paper, of course. I've personally experienced the people coming along with 5.5-inch floppies, tape, cards. That's all. Now, to some extent, that's more secure because... but there's all sorts of stuff out there. And maybe, you actually, if you're taking a devil's advocate position, you might say, well, actually, let's not have an audit with a friendly person. Let's go for one of the most unfriendly and really turn them over and make an example. It may not be popular.
Well, I think, obviously we discuss things like that as well, but we tend, the management of my university tends to not want to upset anybody. That sounds unusual, I know, but we do have very good industrial relations at Teesside, and they do that partly by having a more constructive approach to things. So I don't think we'd be very likely to get the approval for doing that, to be honest. But I think getting a few friendlies and just saying, you know, let's be open and honest about what we find, that might help.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, discs, I've got lots of those as well. I've even got an 8-inch floppy disk in my head.
That's brilliant. Thank you once again. Next up, if I could invite Rob Brucano from Cambridge. Thanks, Rob. Did you have slides? Right, yes. So, bear with us, ladies and gents. There we go. Time is here, and I'm starting you now.
Okay, so this is a sensationalist title, Digital Terrorism Made Easy. How easy? Well, I was slightly nervous about doing this talk because it's so easy that anyone in this room could go away from this talk and do some crimes. So what sort of terrorism am I talking about? I'm talking about distributed denial of service attacks, which are getting much easier. 10 gigabits per second attacks are becoming very prevalent. That's enough not to just be instantly disruptive to the service that's being attacked, but it's also going to disrupt your infrastructure probably, particularly as those attacks get larger and larger. You know, some people here are sitting on 20 gigabits pipes to Janet. In addition to the immediate effects, you're going to potentially have a null route applied to your server by your service provider, which could take a lot longer to be removed than the initial attack lasts. And if you're with a commercial ISP, you could even be fired as a customer. You could have that ISP tell you that they don't want you as a customer anymore. So there are a bunch of different ways to do denial of service attacks. I'm not going to talk about activists working together. I'm talking about botnets. And botnets have been evolving over the years. This is a picture of a classic botnet with a command and control infrastructure, compromised clients running some malware. Then we've seen the emergence of peer-to-peer botnets with the Zeus malware. But the new trend that I'm seeing with botnets, which I'm particularly worried about, which is the focus of this talk, is the emergence of booter services. So what this is the productization of botnets and the commercial sale of them. And this is happening right now. Here's the website of one of these services. Here's a very, very convenient pricing plan. You can see it's priced for every potential user. We have a very reasonable introductory price package there. So we can get up and running very easily. You'll see there's a few nice features there. A Skype resolver, why do we need that? You can ask me a question about that later if you want. We've got a client that I can run on my desktop. So the technical level that I need to use this service is now non-existent. I can just walk up and use this thing. So you might say, okay, it's a crime. I still want to stay anonymous while I'm doing this. So I'm maybe going to use some Bitcoin to buy these services, and I'm going to launder my money with Bitcoin. Or I'm going to try and remain anonymous using Tor, or I'm going to use some free public Wi-Fi and a burner laptop or something to try and retain my anonymity so that no one can catch me for doing these crimes. But actually, at the moment, Tradecraft doesn't really seem to be required in a lot of cases with DDoS because the police aren't really capable of dealing with these incidents for a lot of different reasons. In particular, if you can't demonstrate financial loss, you probably won't even get your report responded to. And that's not just the UK police, that's the US police as well. They have a website you can submit a report to, which will be ignored. And this has been Janet's experience as well, even with the connections that they've got talking to law enforcement. So this has created a new class of attacker. This is a guy with a public identity. Everyone knows who he is. And he's got a Visa card or a PayPal account. And he's just able to ruin your day right away. So this is creating this class of attacker who previously would have to, you know, you've got these hackers who are quite skilled, maybe. They're at least possibly educated. Maybe they've got some kind of moral justification for what they're doing. Or another big user of botnets was organized criminals who would put together, you know, they would hire hackers to make these botnets for them and use them for extortion, things like that. And those classes of attackers have now been joined by this guy who doesn't really have any particular justification for what he's doing above that he wants to watch the world burn, and he's got $5 in his pocket. So this is the new world that we're moving into with the emergence of these services. I've put this slide up here because there's a saying about Samuel Colt, which is he made all men equal. And this revolver that he produced, it wasn't the first revolver, well, it certainly wasn't the first firearm, but it was the first mass-produced, productized revolver. And that is why we remember Samuel Colt for making all men equal. And I think that these services are doing the same for DDoS attacks. That's all I've got to say about that.
Thank you very much, Rob, with 50-odd seconds to spare there. Again, open the floor to questions, please.
Are the commoditized services you showed there easy to defend against or mitigate against?
This is something that I've got a great deal of experience with personally because I'm the sheriff here. So the way that you deal with these, I was going to potentially go on and talk a lot about the Wild West and how the emergence of the revolver changed the Wild West, but it's a lightning talk, so I can't do that. But I think that the emergence of these services is moving us into a world where we have to use specialized service providers to protect against these attacks if we're not going to police against them. And the specialized service providers I'm talking about are people that have enormous connections to the internet, big peerings. So there's a company we heard from yesterday. Well, actually, we didn't hear directly from them, Akamai, who have recently bought Prolexic. Prolexic are the market leaders in this. If you're an ISP, you want to peer with Prolexic, and they'll give you intelligence and pipes and specialist rack-mounted equipment that can filter this stuff and deal with them. Then going down a bit, you've got companies like Black Lotus and Java Pipe. You can get a dedicated server on their protected network. That's a fantastic way to deal with attacks like this. If you're only protecting HTTP, you can use Cloudflare, very good indeed. Moving down a bit, you can do some homebrew. You can get maybe not a dedicated server, but a VPS on a protected network, very cheap. You can get a lot of protection for a VPS right now. I know a deal where you can get 500 gigabits per second protection from a company in Romania for something like $40 a month. And then you homebrew using a multiple gateways into your network through these VPSs, and it's very cheap to do. But if you're immediately facing this attack and you need to fix it, you need to make sure you've got some of your infrastructure outside the affected pipe, so you're able to reroute your DNS. And you probably just want to go and buy a dedicated server from someone like Black Lotus and put your stuff on there if it's like an existing web server that's under heavy attack. And that's for a high-risk service that you're expecting to have attacked regularly.
Does anyone have another question? In which case, thanks again to Rob. Next up, I'd like to invite Matt Johnson from Eduserve, who's going to talk to us about AWS. Did you have any slides, Matt? Just hit the magic button again.
Hi, okay. Thank you. So this is a talk I gave about 6 months ago. The pricing's slightly out of date. But really, it's looking at the myth of public cloud, Amazon. Pricing still has a long way to go down. Google's done some work with that recently. It's going to keep going that way. But does price even matter? So one of the myths you hear is that the big cloud providers are making huge margins. Operating on very tight margins. Really? So all the figures I'm going to use here are publicly available list prices. No special discounts, no volume purchasing. It's from companies. You can go and browse their websites now and see the pricing. So if you go to Amazon and you ask for a small on-demand instance, you'll get one virtual core, which is what they call one EC2 unit, 1.7 gigs of memory, and 160 gigs of storage. That at that time was about $47 per month. Okay, so what is that? So if you do some research and do some digging on the internet, you can see that one Amazon compute unit is about 350 to 400 CPU marks. So if you look at a typical Intel CPU from 6-7 months ago, a typical one can deliver 20. If you look at the instance storage, 160 gig, if you allow some provisioning for formatting and so on, you assume that each instance needs 200. And if you look at the memory, 1.7 gig plus some overhead for virtualization, 2 gig. So what we're saying is that to host 40 small Amazon instances, you need a dual proc CPU, 80 gig of RAM, and 16 terabytes of RAID storage, giving around 6 terabyte usable. So how much does that actually cost? Well, if you go out to Broadbury and you ask them for that configuration of server, it'll cost you about $4,000, which over 36 months is about 111 quid, if you assume just a three-year lifespan. What does it cost per rack? Well, £107 per month. You can get 24 of them in a rack, 12 kilowatts per rack. Logicalis will sell you a rack for that price for $3,800 a month. So if you work it out, you get 24 servers per month at about $6,500. So how much does it cost per instance? Well, each you can get 960 instances per rack, 24 servers, 40 instances. Do you only assume 50% utilization? Because obviously cloud providers have to worry about budgeting on over-allocation and so on. So the monthly cost per instance for an Amazon instance is about £13.55. So just to recap, an Amazon price 30, cost for a small instance about £13.50, 121% markup. But what about support? Okay, well, if you assume, and I'm pretty sure they don't do this, that you have one full-time person per rack just looking after the kit, you pay that person £3,000 per month, then you add on £6.25 per VM. So your total cost, including support, close on 20 quid, still a 52% markup. Software? Well, Amazon rule their own, but if you use something like OpenStack, you could build a service that is technically free of licensing costs. Therefore, you're still building up a margin of 52%. However, the pricing I've mentioned doesn't include Amazon's volume purchasing. I'm pretty sure they don't buy servers for $4,000 a pop. I'm pretty sure they run them higher than 50% utilization. They do spot and reserved instance pricing, which, although it seems like a good deal, actually just enables them to forward plan and sell excess capacity so they generate more, more load on their servers. They design their custom DCs so they get a better PUE than someone like Logicalis could ever dream of, or indeed anyone else who's not running at hyperscale. and really run one FTE per rack? No, I think it's probably more like 1 to 100. So Amazon markup's probably far higher. Now, I've obviously skipped around all the IP around developing these services and marketing, and if you look at Amazon services, they offer a huge range of different services, but you know, at a pure infrastructure level, there's a lot of margin going on. I can do it for S3 as well. I'll do it very quickly in one slide. Amazon, you buy a terabyte of storage for 550 quid per year. A four-year storage with 144 terabytes costs you 14K, 10 of those in a rack. Total price per month, 7,800. If you assume a 3-to-1 ratio, the same as Amazon S3 does, so you replicate three times and add an overhead for storage, that works out about £1.81 per terabyte per month. If you assume only utilized for 25% over the 3 years, it gives you £86 per terabyte per year, so a 540% markup. But does it really matter anyway? Because ultimately, you don't buy cloud services on price, it's on flexibility, it's on adaptability, it's doing stuff you can't do, and it's about choosing what's right for the cloud. 22 seconds. Thank you.
There we go. Brilliant. Does anyone have any questions for Matt? I think your case was pretty much open and shut, so thanks again. Next up, and I'd like to see how he's going to get out of where he's sitting currently, is my colleague Rhys, who's going to talk to us about Raptor. Do you have any slides, Rhys?
Nope.
Then we can...
Don't even know where I'm going to say.
Switch across. And you're off.
Okay, hello. Software update, nope. Firefox. Yeah, Rhys Smith, Janet, Cardiff University. One of the things we've done over the last few years is develop a piece of software called Raptor. If you don't know what it is a piece of software to look at the log files of your authentication systems, initially targeting the Shibboleth IDP and EasyProxy, even though EasyProxy is not an authentication system, to see what people are doing and to give you a good overview of what people are logging into. So that if you don't know how to use tools like grep and things like that, which librarians usually don't, I don't want to insult them all, but you know, it's not typically in their skill set, and they want to see what kind of resources are being used, they want nice flashy graphs instead. So what Raptor is a piece of software which will sit on next to your, say, Shibboleth IDP or EasyProxy, or nowadays, we released a new version last week, sit on FreeRadius to give you Eduroam stats or Moonshot stats, or the Open Athens LA instance as well. It'll support now. So I was just going to show you what it looks like. There you go. That's what it looks like. That's my talk. No. Login screen. See if the live demo fairies are kind to me today or not. So what happens is you don't really need to see the detail, but I'll show you. You log in, you get access to, probably shouldn't walk too far away from the mic, you get access to the dashboard, which will show you things like, by the way, don't look too closely because this is Cardiff's real stats, so probably shouldn't be showing you this. You can see, for example, this is the dashboard that, you know, senior management types like. So this is today, the default here is today, this is what people have been logging into today. How many logins there have been, how many unique users, top five resources by amount of users, top five by logins, so depth and breadth of usage. And you can do today and last week and last month and last year and switch between systems, so SHIB IDP versus EasyProxy versus Eduroam. I haven't set it up for Eduroam yet. And you can mark things as internal or external if you wanted to see the difference. So, you know, we've got SAML authentication to our internal things, which dwarf, you know, e-resource usage. So you can switch between internal and external. And that's just the dashboard. There is then a graphs page where you can go and do whatever you want. One thing Raptor can do is add identity information that doesn't appear in the log files. So, for example, you can take the username and go to LDAP and get the department and things like that that the user's from, so you can view usage by department. So, for example, let's have a look at how many people have been
logging in this month, say from the 1st of March till today, to all SAML systems broken down by department. So which departments are the biggest users of SAML authentication? The graphs take a little while to compute here because this has got 8 million records in the database, so it takes a little while to do queries over them. That's actually broken down by affiliation. So let's do this one. So logins by department. Hey, there you go. Nice graph. So you can see which departments are the biggest users. And it's that one there. I don't know what that is. Or that one. That's CARBS, Cardiff Business School. And you can do things like look at the table view if it's too hard to look at the graph and download the Excel version of it and CSV and that kind of thing. It's also a nice little friendly wizard we've added. So instead of quite a complex cover off page, one of the bits of feedback we got was that was a bit complicated. We've got kind of a step-by-step wizard. And you can do things like anything that's in the log files you can graph over, basically. So for example, one thing that's in the SHIB log file is the SAML profile in use, which I'm sure nobody cares about, but I do. So you can see, for example, SAML 1 versus SAML 2 usage. So if this was EduRoam, you could be looking at which places your users are roaming to and which people from which department are roaming to different places, things like that. So all in all, actually a fairly powerful tool and lets you understand what your users are doing on your systems without having to know SQL, how to do SQL queries or how to do grep and things like that. And there you go.
At which point we draw a close.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Therese. You can tell a man who trusts his own software if he'll do a live demo in front of people. Do we have any questions on Raptor?
Google Raptor. Yeah, it'll get you there. Otherwise, it's IAM, so Identity Access Management. IAM.cf.ac.uk/Raptor. RPMs, MSIs are available.
Brilliant. Well, Rhys has walked off stage, so that was the last question. I do recommend you check it out if you're monitoring your AIM systems, because it's a very powerful tool and a lot of effort has gone into it. Next up, another Janet colleague, if Melissa would like to take the stand. I'm going to lose that.
Yeah, that's one.
Oh, no, let's find the right one. There you go. Right, starting now.
Hi, I'm Melissa, for those of you that don't know me, and I lead the web team at Janet. I'm here to talk to you about community.ja.net, which is an exciting new platform we have created for you. To do this, I'd like to introduce you to a couple of people I know in the research and education sectors. This is Kim, and she administers the Janet Video Conferencing Service, or JVCS, on behalf of her organisation. Kim recently took over from a colleague, and she isn't very familiar with JVCS. She needs some help. Kim wants to know if there are ways to start a video conference instantly without having to schedule it in advance. Have any of you out here been in a similar position and needed to contact us about any of our services, needed any help? That's good. Well, instead of contacting us in the usual ways, what if there was a way that Kim could ask us a question once, and not only could all Janet staff answer it, but the rest of the sector could help too? What if someone's actually already asked the same question, so Kim can just find the answer immediately? Community.ja.net provides the way to do this. You can ask a question to over 5,000 people in less time than it takes to phone just one. With more than 8 people joining the site every day, why don't you have a go next time you have a question? So as you can see, this is exactly what Kim did. She posted a question and she quickly got replies from Janet staff and from other people like her in the sector. Besides Kim, you can see other people want to hold instant video conferences, like Dave, Ed, and Jenny. Don't know how well they come up there. For those of you who are wondering, starting a video conference instantly is already part of JVCS or vSCENE, but for this example, let's pretend it's not. Ed saw Kim's question and thought to himself, I want to take this further. If enough people are interested, let's make this happen. But where can he go to get people interested? How can he share his idea with everyone in the sector at the same time? Not quite sure what's going on here. And get feedback. Community.ja.net provides the place to do this. Ed decides to share his idea on the community platform, where over 5,000 people see it. You can see a lot of people like Ed's idea, including Jenny, who we met earlier, and Dave, who has already been working to achieve instant VCs on his own, but hasn't finished yet. Jenny hasn't got the resource to help develop a solution at the moment, but she would love to stay up to date with progress, and she's happy to pilot the end result. Ed's attracted enough interest, and together with Dave and other like-minded people, he decides to write the software needed. But where can they go to share their requirements with each other, and where can they collate their ideas? Where can they go to keep Jenny up to date at the same time? And also, they need to keep continuing, attracting the interest of others in the sector, because they want to share this functionality with people who'll find it useful. Guess what? Community.ja.net also provides the place to do this. You can share knowledge with everyone in the research and information sectors, education sectors, or stay up to date with information other people are sharing. Ed uses the site to manage the project, inviting people to share their needs. As we know, Jenny can't contribute technically, but she too has fed back her requirements to the group. Ed regularly posts progress updates, so Jenny and the other members are always up to date. Community.ja.net is the place for you to feed back and for you to contribute to projects like-minded people are working on. If you want to follow Ed's progress or even get involved, you can do it here. Or you can browse the site and join special interest groups, as well as groups dedicated to particular projects. The community platform is the place to go if you need to find help, inspiration, like-minded people to work with, or a space to share your knowledge and ideas. By answering questions, sharing ideas and your knowledge, you can help us to help you. You can feedback to build and grow Janet services, and you can use your experience to benefit everyone in the sector. And their experience will benefit you. So whoever you are, and whatever you want to do, we've created a way for you to join the conversation. So whatever you want to achieve, come and do it with us online. That's all. Thank you.
Brilliant. Came in at just 16 seconds to go. Any questions on the community portal?
I wondered if someone would spot that. Well, it works a bit like Stack Overflow. I don't know if anyone's familiar with it, and other kind of technical forums. Points give you ratings, and you earn badges like gurus, ninjas. Well, these are things that's still to come, but eventually we're working up towards kind of a leadership system. I'm not promising prizes with points, but they're definitely there for a reason, and we put them in at the beginning. Might get shot if I promise that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again to Melissa. Okay, there was one final speaker that I hadn't managed to track down last night and confirm. Tomo, are you in the room? Are you ready to speak for us? Just looking everywhere else and not seeing you there. Okay, so our final speaker, Tomo.
Where is it? Don't know how this works. Let's try that. There we go. All right. So,
and you're off.
This is a couple of slides from a talk that I did at the end of January for USISA regarding what we're doing at London Business School at the moment. We've effectively embarked on a cloud transition, but it's what we call cloud on our terms. So we've effectively gone off to the market, and we had three issues to solve. One was two main issues really. We needed to get out of our on-campus data center. It was a single point of failure for us. Quite a few things that needed to be fixed. It needed new investment, and the school just wanted the space on campus for teaching and research. So the clear thing there was we need to go off-site. So we went off into the market, and we've actually procured a solution from Phoenix IT Services for two data centres. Right, so the main one's based in Farnborough, and our backup is based in Birstall, near here. And then the other part of it was that we didn't really want to run a phone system anymore. There's some really, really aging old PBXs. Nobody actually thanks me for running them. They just complain when it goes wrong. So the school wanted to go to Microsoft Link, but we could see that 365 isn't mature for kind of a PBX replacement. So we actually found somebody who will host Microsoft Link for us in their cloud on our terms, and actually integrate it with Office 365. So we're now actually going to end up with a solution. It's a kind of busy, networky type of slide, so it will appear and appeal to a few of the geeks here. So in the bottom left-hand corner, you've got the school's campus. We've created our own WAN, which is going up into the Phoenix cloud. Effectively, the stuff there is effectively the same equipment that the school would have bought if we were buying it on campus. So it's exactly the same kind of stuff, but we're buying that as a managed service. So they will run and feed all of the equipment for us, but we actually start to play at the operating system layer. So we don't have to worry about the tin, about patching it. It's taking away a whole bunch of stuff that we just get criticised for when it goes wrong. Then on the other side, we've got Link, which will be hosted for us by a company called Outsourcery, and that's going to be integrated with Office 365. So if a phone call's unanswered, then the voicemail actually appears in your Office 365 mailbox. And of course, in the middle of it, actually tying it all together is Janet. We've actually created our own WAN, but for Office 365, we've actually given Outsourcery a 1 gig link off of Janet, and we'll consume that over the Janet network. Right, so just to paint a brief picture, you've kind of got the standard offering of 365. You can't change anything. Outsourcery is pretty much their standard product, but we've managed to tweak it a little bit for our own purposes. So although they don't like playing around too much, we're a reasonable size customer for them, and they wanted to make that change. And then the overall solution that we've got with Phoenix is pretty much what we would have had on campus, but actually it's being run for us, and we just play at the layer that we can add value. And I thought that the whole point of actually wanting to speak about this is to highlight it's not really about the technology for us now. It's actually transforming the way we work. As an infrastructure team, we need to learn skills now to actually make sure we're interacting with these suppliers effectively and efficiently for the school, and actually trying to make sure that we add value and actually try to stop having to worry about stuff that we don't actually have that much street cred for, right? So if the SAN fails, yes, you'll still blame IT, but it'll be somebody else that's is there actually trying to maintain the service and fix it. So I've got 10 seconds left. If anybody's got any questions about stuff that we're doing, please don't hesitate to ask.
Brilliant, thank you so much. Did we have any questions?
Yes, it'll be for everybody. The plan will be for, all of the people who've got a locked office effectively with a phone, so their link will come from the Outsourcery link, but the students hopefully will actually, as a phase three in the project, actually take their link from 365 and it'll all be federated together. We were able to look at the points in between the core of our campus network and our and the on-site campus data center and actually see that, I mean, we weren't actually hitting more than a gig at the moment. So, yeah.
I think there was a question from Alan.
Hello, Alan.
Two questions, if I do cheeky.
Yeah. Two for price of one, that's fine.
First one is, now that Microsoft have released Office for iOS and it's a pain to be able to edit and everything else on it, you need to change your 365 license. I looked at the license and you said you have for your staff and students.
Yes.
You can deal with the licenses so they can get all the lovely Office Joy on their iPads or manage their expectations.
So the licenses we're going to buy to start off with is the Exchange Online Plan 2. So it won't enable A3 stuff, and we'll slowly unlock that as we're ready to support it. So yeah, the phase one is to just do email, and then we'll unlock other stuff.
And the second question was, you said you don't have to look after this, the sound is dealt with by someone else.
Yes.
Your end user, your clients, customers on site, they don't know that, they still think it's IT that's out there.
Correct, yes. But, I mean, hopefully you've got the likes of Phoenix who are doing this for multiple customers, and I mean the small team here in the school is, I mean, we're okay with a SAN, but we're not experts at it. And if you get that bug come up or whatever, the chances are you would hope that Phoenix have seen the bug somewhere else, because they're doing this for hundreds of customers. They can actually fix it quicker. They've got the higher level of support to actually go in at gold partner level to deal with shit that crops up, basically. Any other questions?
Are you really happy giving all your data to the NSA via...
You've got to take a fairly pragmatic view of this, and there may be a few staff members who are doing stuff at the school that may cause them to question this strategy, but ultimately it's just a bunch of email, and I mean you can have opposing views, and if you speak to David, who's behind you, he would probably have a few more concerns about it. But ultimately, if they want to look at this data, they're going to get hold of it one way or the other. So let's just make it easy for them.
We've got one more at the back and then one at the front here.
Okay.
Robin Breed, Upstra Brooks. What are Phoenix doing for you with regard to backup?
So you've got the two sites, right? And at the two sites you've got a SAN, right? And the two SANs actually are there for each other. So
that's some resilience and replication, yes. But actual backup, like I need to fall back a month.
It's all on the SAN. Which is precisely the thing that we do at the moment on campus, and that's worked for us over the past 5 years. So the school takes quite a hard view at persuading how much... So if you came to me and said, I had a file on the S drive 4 months ago, we can't recover it. We only keep 3 months' worth of data. And actually having that conversation led by a professional to actually engage and actually understand the critical RPOs for business actually can really focus people's minds and actually understand, well, then if I haven't spotted that I didn't have it in 3 months, actually, is it worth it? So I mean, the school's had that conversation, it's all understood and agreed, signed off. So we actually don't keep that much data for a very long time.
I presume as part of this process you looked at cost. Now, was there a big decrease, about the same? What were the costs of doing this compared to, say, doing it in-house or whatever?
So I think if you were to look at it over the five-year term, then it's cost neutral. But the school would have had to make an investment of over £100,000, £200,000, just to fix our existing data centre room. And you still need one off-site. So actually, why make it hard for yourselves to actually run that room? Our poor estates people hate me every time I phone up and say the air conditioning's on the blink again, or the cafe that they installed in the room directly above the data centre has leaked water through the ceiling again and turned up on the servers. This happened, yeah, believe it or not. And I mean, the school might be a world-class business school, but we're not world-class at running data centres. It's just a pile of baggage that over the years has just bitten us on the bum one time too many. And it's not our fault in IT, it's just stuff happens. So overall, it's probably cost neutral for us.
Can you tell your students that all their data is
going to
be owned by the NSA?
Yes.
You tell them that?
Yeah.
So they're quite aware of that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you once again, no. Tomo. Thank you for an interesting talk. Right. That was the end of our speakers today. I just have a couple of observations, and I think it's only fair that I put myself under the same discipline as everyone else, and I also have one pleasant duty to perform. The observations are, isn't it fantastic that we can fill a room like this with people turning up early in the morning after a hard night the night before, just in the hope and the knowledge that their colleagues will be contributing interesting, relevant, useful nuggets of information for you. We haven't pushed this at you, we haven't sold the content here, you've just trusted your colleagues, and I think that's brilliant. I also think it's brilliant that we, Janet, can just say over the course of really a day and a half of this conference, we did a little bit of sort of twittering in the lead up, we just said, you know, come and fill this time slot, provide us with some content. And whether it's the people who are able to create this on a bus and just turn up and talk off the top of their head and still really give a compelling presentation, or those that have really put some time in and produced a polished set of slides for us, it's just brilliant we can do that. And I'm also very proud to be part of an organisation that will open the stage like this, putting no filters between the speakers and yourselves as the audience, and we just trust the community that you won't abuse the privilege of having this platform. And I think all of the presentations have been really excellent and interesting this morning, and will you join me in thanking everybody once again?
This recording was brought to you by Janet Training as part of NetWorkshop Online. Further information is available on our website at www.ja.net/training.